If you have your Bibles, let me invite you to turn with me to Ephesians chapter 5. Way back when, I think maybe the first week, we gave you a definition of grace that was this: to extend favor or kindness to one who doesn't deserve it and can never earn it. And boy, doesn't that fit with our family sometimes, right? People who don't deserve it and can never earn it. And we're going to talk about Ephesians 5 and really the first part of Ephesians chapter 6. I told you the story last week that when I was a little guy, my older brother Dave worked for a summer for a farmer in our community. And one of the weeks during the summer, I don't know if it was earlier or later, but I just remember one of the weeks the farmer left on vacation, leaving my brother Dave high school. Actually, he would have been a college age young guy, just in charge of the farm, and I don't know what all his responsibilities were. The only thing that I remember, and I told you this last week, was that at one point in the week, he came home explaining that the truck, the farm truck that he had been left to use, had stopped running. The engine had ground to a halt, and it wasn't very long before we understood that Dave had forgot to check the oil, and for whatever reason, the oil, you know, those old farm trucks had run out. Because he didn't check it, he didn't refill it. Without the oil in the engine, all those parts rubbing together stopped the vehicle. So I can remember this story. It's happening. It's pretty traumatic for Dave, of course, for your boss to be gone and to come home to a truck that doesn't run anymore. But I got a lesson in engine lubrication. You see, an engine has a lot of parts that rub together. And when those parts rub together, they produce friction or they produce heat. And so that's the reason why we have oil in a vehicle. It lubricates those moving metal parts so that the friction is reduced, the heat is reduced, and the car, the engine, can operate appropriately. And listen, that is exactly what happens in every marriage and in every family. We have different parts rubbing together in the context of a home, and that creates friction. It creates heat. So grace is like the oil that lubricates when parts rub up against each other. But if you pull that oil of grace out of the equation, then everything grinds to a halt. I think that's the explanation that we're going to try to use to define this very important biblical instruction in regarding the family. There are three primary texts in the New Testament that deal with marriage and deal with the family. We're actually going to look briefly at a couple of them, but 1 Corinthians 7 is one, Ephesians 5 and 6, that's our primary spot this morning, and then 1 Peter 3. Of course, the family is talked about in some other areas, both in the Old Testament and the New Testament. But I would see these three texts as the primary three that deal with marriage and the family. The word grace is not used in any of the three. But I want to tell you that it's here in the privacy of one's home that grace faces its major test. And it's a test that begins not too many days after the honeymoon ends. One guy put it this way. He said, every marriage has three rings: an engagement ring, a wedding ring, and suffering. And actually, that's true. It really is true. And I'm not somebody that mocks marriage. You're never going to hear me, you know, there's some guys that seem to constantly kind of belittling the idea of marriage. You're not going to hear that from me. I'm not saying that in a mocking tone. I really believe in marriage, and I believe in marriages that are awesome and fulfilling and everything that God ordained it to be. So that's not what I'm trying to say. But I would tell you that there is going to be suffering in your marriage. There's going to be suffering in your home, because anytime you take two people from different backgrounds, and even if they have a lot of the same background, from different families and from different settings, and you bring them together after 20 or 30 years of life living apart, and you put them in the same place trying to live out a life day by day together, there is going to be friction. Two different parts that are rubbing together is going to produce heat. And in some homes, there's a lot of heat. And so this is the reason that we have to have grace. And I think the Bible talks a lot about it. And I want to tell you that in the home where grace rules, have you ever walked into a house where it just smelled so good when you walked in? Maybe it's because something is baking, you know, in the oven, or I don't know. There's just some homes that you walk into and they just smell so good right when you walk in. I think that that's what a grace-permeated home smells like. It's just enveloped with an aroma, a sweet smell pervading that place. And it's the smell, I would suggest to you, it's the aroma of grace. So wouldn't it be great if your marriage, and wouldn't it be great if your home and your family smelled like that? And I want to tell you that it can. In fact, one of the things that we've been saying all along in this series is the idea that grace is one of these characteristics that we can grow in. It's not something like a character, like a, you know, some sort of a personality trait. You either have it or you don't have it. Grace is a spiritual character trait that we have to, in fact, 1 Peter 3 tells us that we are called to grow in this grace. So this is something that can grow. So if you're here this morning and you would say, man, my home doesn't smell like grace, I could tell you that. And I'm not sure what it smells like, but it doesn't smell like grace. Or my marriage, or my relationships with my family, it does not smell like grace. I want to bring before you the idea this morning that it can. And it should. And this is something that can change when the gospel of Jesus Christ and when your understanding of the grace that you received from God begins to flow in the life that you live around you. And that's what I'm going to encourage you with here this morning. With that in mind, I want to read Ephesians chapter 5, beginning in verse 17, then we'll skip down to 21 and read into chapter 6. Paul, speaking to the church at Ephesus, says, "Wherefore, be ye not unwise, but understanding what the will of the Lord is." And I want to just pull out that verse sort of as the context to help us, each of us. Listen, don't be unwise. Don't miss this. Don't skip over it in your understanding of your Christian life. Don't be unwise, but understand what the will of the Lord is. Go down to verse 21. Here's this text about the family. "Submitting yourselves one to another in the fear of God. Wives, submit yourselves unto your own husbands as unto the Lord. For the husband is the head of the wife, even as Christ is the head of the church, and he is the Savior of the body. Therefore, as the church is subject unto Christ, so let the wives be to their own husbands in everything. Husbands, love your wives, even as Christ also loved the church and gave himself for it, that he might sanctify and cleanse it with the washing of water by the word. That he might present it to himself a glorious church, not having spot or wrinkle or any such thing, but that it should be holy and without blemish. So ought men to love their wives as their own bodies. He that loveth his wife loveth himself. For no man ever yet hated his own flesh, but nourisheth and cherisheth it, even as the Lord the church. For we are members of his body, of his flesh, and of his bones. For this cause shall a man leave his father and mother, and shall be joined," very important word, "shall be joined unto his wife, and they too shall be one flesh. This is a great mystery. But I speak concerning Christ and the church. Nevertheless, let every one of you in particular so love his wife even as himself, and the wife see that she reverence her husband. Children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. Honor thy father and mother, which is the first commandment with a promise. And what is that promise? Well, that it may be well with thee, and that thou mayest live long on the earth. And ye fathers, provoke not your children to wrath, but bring them up in the nurture and the admonition of the Lord. I want to talk to you this morning about four virtues of a family that's oiled by grace. So the text that we just read is sort of outlined for us by roles. I mean, that's the outline that comes just as we read through it. We have the role of the wife and the husband and the children and fathers. And we have the whole family structure that's outlined for us, defining responsibilities and how we're to interact within the home. But what I'd like to do is try to look at it more broadly, because the whole thing just describes life in the family. I think that's what it does, what it's going to take, what it should look like. So I'm not going to walk down through the text and talk about the wives and husbands and children and fathers. We're not going to look at it that way, but maybe try to overview it and see it in more broad terms of the character traits that are developed within a home that God's pleased with. And what I think that you see is that there are certain qualities that just envelop that this sort of aroma that we're talking about that pervades the home, that is permeated with grace. So I want to just walk through these four virtues of a family oiled by grace. If you can imagine that these are like the walls in your house, the home that you're building, these four virtues that will help this home sustain through the storms of life. Number one, would you write down mutual unselfishness? And then two, I'm actually going to bring you right to the number two. We're going to talk about these together. Write down sacrificial servanthood. Mutual unselfishness and sacrificial servanthood. I'm going to talk about them together for time's sake, but really because the product of unselfish living is sacrificial servanthood. So they flow together, serving each other. And boy, let me tell you, you see this all through the passage, right? Just skim with me. Verse 21 talks about submitting yourselves. Verse 22 talks about wives submitting to their husbands. Verse 25 says, husbands, love and give yourself up for your wives. Verses 1 and 2, instructing, talking to children, says, children, obey and honor. Okay, so all of this just has the aroma of complete unselfishness within the family toward the other members of the family. Instead of the idea of every man for himself, every woman for herself, it seems like that's how it is in some families. Boy, forget about you, because I've got my own agenda. I mean, I got these things that are important to me, and the rest of you are just going to have to figure it out, because, I mean, it's about me. My world is here, and you know, husband, wife, children, parents. I mean, you guys just figure it out because life revolves around me. That's who my focus is on. God says that's not how it should be. It doesn't work that way. In fact, it never works that way. There's never a home that has the mutual love and compassion and enjoyment that's supposed to be a part of a family if the residents within that home are all going their own way, trying to do their own thing. At least it doesn't work without great conflict, without great friction. So instead, I think this text tells us to give yourself unselfishly to this family. Don't think about it in terms of yourself. Think about it in terms of the family structure and your ability to serve and to care for each other. So what does it take to operate unselfishly? I would tell you that it takes grace. It takes grace to accept the others and their thoughts and their opinions. It takes grace to overlook the things that happen routinely within these relationships that are frustrating to you. It takes grace to understand the perspective of the other people in the home and within the relationship. It takes grace to forgive. And listen, there are no family relationships that are healthy without a very, very heavy dose of forgiveness that is wrapped around in that family. Right? Forgiveness when that person absolutely, at least in your mind, does not deserve forgiveness. I mean, that's the words that we're using as we define grace. Grace is giving to somebody who does not deserve it. So forgiving somebody when they don't deserve it. It makes me think back to the big forgiveness text. We've referenced it a couple of times in this series in Matthew chapter 18, where Peter comes to Jesus and he says, remember that story? How often should I forgive my brother? Till seven times. I think many times we skip over the brother word. I don't know, really. I've never looked back and studied if Peter's just talking in generalities, but that's usually how we see it in generalities. How often do I forgive this person who has offended me? But listen, this might not be any more true than it is within the home. Because our brothers and our sisters and our spouses and our children and even our parents, they regularly offend us, and maybe that is exactly what Peter was saying. How many times do I forgive my brother? Man, because he keeps doing the same exact thing to me. How many times do I forgive him? And remember, Jesus' response is 70 times 7. So grace to forgive, grace to respect, grace to yield your own rights, grace to restrain your own agenda. So if you were to evaluate yourself this morning, do you find yourself in your marriage, in your family relationships, with your brothers and with your sisters and with your moms and with your dads, whether those relationships are in your home right now or even those relationships that you don't live in the same house but you have that ongoing relationship, do you find that you are more concerned with yourself, with your own happiness, with how that relationship is affecting you, with your own needs being met? Do you find it's more about that? Or is it about unselfishly serving the other members of your family? And in fact, could I ask you this? What would your spouse say about that? What would your mom say about that if you were to ask her about how unselfish you are as you relate to her? In fact, here's a good evaluation question. Are you flexible and willing to adapt your plans for the good of another family member? Because we're asked to do this all the time within our families, aren't we? Or do you get real uptight when things don't go according to your schedule or your plan? I had a real personal failure in this area this week. It's going to seem silly to you, but it was important to me. I was going for a run earlier in the week, and I was all set, ready to head out the door, and then I thought that I would ask Faith if she wanted to come along and walk while I ran. So I asked Faith if she wanted to come, and she said, yes, I'd like to come. And so she got ready to go real quick, and we're ready to go, and she said to me, I'm embarrassed telling you this, but she said to me, can we go here? Which I wanted to go there. I hadn't told her that. I wanted to go there. And she said, can we go here? And I said, no, we can't go here. I want to go there. I mean, I've got a routine. I didn't even explain all this. I just said, you know, I want to go there. And so, she decided not to come, and I went running on my own. And I'm telling you, it was a miserable run. It took me just a little bit of time to think about, why in the world could I not adjust my little routine so that she could come with me? Right? Anybody else have anything like that happen this week, or is that just me? I don't know. But we're like that, right? We get our own plans in place. We get our agenda in place. And it's a big test that I failed pretty clearly this week in the test, because a test is, am I willing to adapt to maybe what somebody else might prefer in this situation? Or is it about me? Is it about what I want and about my plans and my agenda? I'd encourage you to write this down, maybe an application of this, but grace keeps us flexible and willing to adapt. And it's a personal testimony by me this morning. Here's a third virtue, is committed endurance. Verse 31, if you look down at this verse, talks about the permanence of marriage. In fact, there's the one word that I highlighted for you as we read through the word joined in the King James. It has the idea, literally, of glued or cemented together. For this cause shall a man leave his father and his mother and shall be joined unto his wife, and they two shall be one flesh. Real quick, turn with me back to Mark chapter 10. There's a very similar, in fact, Ephesians is really quoting Mark chapter 10, Jesus' words, and I want to read them for you because they add a little bit more context to what this is saying here. Mark 10, verse 6 says, "But from the beginning of the creation, God made them male and female." Here's what we just read in Ephesians. "For this cause shall a man leave his father and mother and cleave to his wife, and they two shall be one flesh, so that then there are no more two, no more twain, but one flesh." And then this part, verse 9, "What therefore God hath joined together." Right? So what the Bible says is that when we get married, it's not just a civil ceremony. It's not just a contract that's been made between two people. God calls it something that he does spiritually, mystically, where the two people become one. What God hath joined together, let not man separate. Let not man put asunder. I want you to look again at 1 Corinthians chapter 7. Just track this for a minute with me. 1 Corinthians chapter 7. Talking about this committed endurance that is a critical component of the oil of grace that allows families to operate in biblical and Christ-honoring ways. 1 Corinthians chapter 7, verse 10 says this, "Unto the married I command you, yet not I, but the Lord, let not the wife depart from her husband. But, and if she depart, let her remain unmarried or be reconciled to her husband, and let not the husband put away his wife. But to the rest speak I, not the Lord. If any brother hath a wife that believeth not, she be pleased to dwell with him, let him not put her away. And the woman which hath a husband that believeth not, and if he be pleased to dwell with her, let her not leave him." And it goes on. I mean, this is pretty clear, right? It's not the only passage. Genesis 2 talks about this. Matthew 5, Matthew 19, Romans 7 all have very similar language about this permanence of the marriage bond. And God's plan for marriage is that it's a lifetime commitment. Two people have become one flesh. And this one flesh idea is something that's mystical and spiritual. So if Paul is writing anything in this section, he's saying, when you marry for life. I mean, it's permanent. Man, here at Harvest, we honor, we lift up these kinds of committed relationships that have endured. So what does it take to stick it out? What does it take to be permanently committed to each other. Man, listen to me, at every age, whether you've been married for 10 years or 20 years or 30 years or 10 months, it's going to take great grace. It takes an enormous amount of grace to negotiate the minefields of a marriage. In fact, are you still in 1 Corinthians chapter 7? This will be interesting for you. If you are, go down to verse 28. We don't have to read the whole, well, let me read it real quick. And if thou marry, thou hast not sinned. If Paul's actually arguing for singleness here in these verses. He says, but if you marry, it's okay. But at the end of the verse, look at this. Nevertheless, this is 1 Corinthians 7:28. Nevertheless, those who have married, such shall have trouble. As in the Bible, all right? Such shall have trouble in the flesh, but I spare you. ESV says, those who marry will have troubles, and I would spare you that. That's what Paul's saying. That's funny. Hey, listen, every bride getting ready to get married who thinks she's found the knight in shining armor who's going to save her from all of her disappointments needs to remember that those who marry will have trouble. That's what Paul says. And every guy, every groom who thinks he's found Wonder Woman, you know, the perfect combination of Mother Teresa and Betty Crocker and Alex Morgan and Kate Middleton. I don't know who this is. But you've got the perfect combination, and you, and I'm not discouraging you. You, and I hope she knows it, that you believe that. I'm all in for that. I just want you to know, such will have trouble. So we have to have grace in our marriages. Because two people coming together are going to have friction. There's going to be heat that's generated. And so we have to have the grace to forgive and to go on. And the grace, listen to me, to hang in tough times. To be committed to endure. To have the grace to stay at it, even though in your marriage the same mistake is made over and over again, or the same sin is committed again and again. I just want to bring before you this morning that a marriage that is well oiled by grace is durable. It's long lasting. It's protected against the wear and tear of friction. If you want to have a marriage that lasts like these that have stood in our midst this morning, it's going to take a big, enormous dose of grace. Finally, if you'd write in virtue number 4 of a family oiled by grace, if you'd write in the idea of deliberate encouragement. Let's skim again Ephesians chapter 5. Verse 25 says, love or give of yourself. 29 talks about nourish and cherishing. Chapter 6, verse 2 says, talking to children, it tells them to honor their parents in words or in actions, to give honor to. This isn't just an attitude. It involves words and actions. Boy, I've heard a lot of kids speak so negatively of their parents. Listen, young people, if I can come along beside you here this morning, don't you do that. God is so not pleased when you talk to your parents or even to your friends about your parents and you cut them down and you disrespect your parents. Listen, God has some very clear language for that. Don't do it. Children, honor your father and your mother, because there's a commandment that's attached to it, according to 2 and 3, that it may be well with you and that you may live long on the earth. This is a promise to you. Verse 4 I think, such a critical verse for fathers and mothers as well, but it's specifically referenced to fathers because I think they have such a huge responsibility in this idea, and it says to bring them up, to nurture them. And I think all of these verses that go throughout this text give us this idea that we must have this deliberate encouragement that's part of a family that's been oiled by grace. Deliberate encouragement means that we're committed to building each other up, not tearing each other down. And for sure, this is a byproduct of a grace-permeated life. It is a byproduct of a grace face. You ought to do a test this week. Tomorrow, when you wake up, your family ought to document how many encouraging words, how many encouraging comments are made in your home during the course of a day or maybe in the course of a week. Document it. If you did that test in your home, what do you think it would look like? And then how many discouraging things are said, the kind of things that tear people down, how many of those could be charted in the course of a day or a week in your home? Hey, kids, man, listen up here. You play a big part in this. Your encouragement, the words that you use with your brothers and sisters, and I know what younger brothers and sisters are like, but listen, this means something. I'm talking to you very specifically. Kids, at whatever age you're at, you play a big part in your home of whether this is going to be a grace-permeated place, and you can do something about it. This isn't just for the adults. This is for you. How about when you talk to your little brother or your little sister or maybe your older brother or older sister that just is bugging you all the time? How about when your brother or your sister has done one of those things that brothers and sisters do? Do you build them up with grace? Or do you tear into them and make them feel stupid? You make them feel stupid so they won't do that again. Hey, dads, husbands, how would you rate your encouragement bucket? You know, the bucket that you have for your family? I mean, there's an encouragement bucket in your family. You may not know it, but it's there. And day by day and week by week, you're deciding whether that bucket that your family needs of your encouragement, whether it's empty or whether it's full. And there's going to be some times in the lives of your family, your children, and even in the life of your wife, but your children especially, when you're going to have to take some withdrawals from that bucket. Because guess what? Life is hard, and our children don't always do the right thing. And we have to step into their lives sometimes with some firmness and discipline, and it's going to feel like a grace withdrawal. Even though that's not what it's meant to be, it's going to feel like a withdrawal, like you're disappointed with them. And listen, if that bucket has not been filled up with encouraging words, then you're going to have nothing for it to draw from in those moments when you got to step into their life with more firmness. Dads, you're going to have to fill up that bucket with encouraging words. Wives, young moms, and you young moms, I feel for this season of your life, it's one of the awesome seasons of life, but we know it's also a great test of the work of God's grace in your life, isn't it? And you might say, and if you only knew my kids... Or if you only knew my husband, you would know how much grace it takes just to get through my day. But you know, that's the challenge of it, isn't it? At the root foundation, here is the meaning of grace. We don't find it when everything's going good. We find it when things are hard and when it's struggling and we feel overwhelmed. This is where we find grace. We don't find it when the kids are little cherubs, little angels. They're doing everything that they should do. We don't need grace then. We need grace when they're tearing the house apart and they're not listening to anything that you say. This is when we're going to find out whether that grace-permeated life is at the core you. And I feel for you. I know the challenge of those days relentless, but I want to give before you the,
the beautiful picture of what a grace-permeated home can look like, what a grace-permeated life can look like.
You remember, grace, the definition is to extend favor or kindness to one who doesn't deserve it and can never earn it. I mean, that's the test. It's easy to show grace to the husband that brings you flowers every day and breakfast in bed and constantly tells you how great you are, but that old scoundrel that you're married to, his breath stinks and he leaves his stinky socks all over the place. He's not as positive as he should be to you, and in fact, some of you live day by day with far more serious offenses than that. But listen to me, the grace of deliberate encouragement is one of the most powerful expressions in all the world. That's the reason, parents, moms, and dads, it's the reason why it's so important that you choose to give words of encouragement to your kids. There are some kids that grow up in life completely void, their lives completely void of any positive interaction. And I'm not talking about falsely building up their self-esteem so that they think they can't do anything wrong. That's not what I'm talking about. But boy, you affirm that those kids are great and that they have so much potential. Hey, listen, dads, one of the greatest tasks in all of the world is being an encouragement to your family. Your daughters, your teens, your preteens, they better know from you of their worth, because your kids are going to find out soon enough that the world isn't always that way. They're going to find out soon enough that not everybody else feels the same way. And they need to know, they need that bucket filled up with their worth, because dad has told them over and over and over again the potential and the goodness that you see. Let me just read this. I came across this not too long ago. It's a little bit longer letter, but it's so powerful to me. A lady, she's actually responding to her pastor when they're talking about some things in counseling, but she wrote this note. Hang in here with this. She said, "My dad was what I thought was a real man. He was the provider and worked hard for our physical needs. He had to go 150 miles away from home to find work, coming home often only on weekends. As could be expected, I didn't know my dad very well. When I reached adolescence, I began to desire more than anything to win his approval. It became an all-consuming need. I went back and forth from being a tomboy to being feminine to try to get him to like me. I took up fishing and made myself pull worms apart and get slime underneath my fingernails so I could bait my own hooks and we could go fishing, but he didn't have time to go fishing anymore. I started playing softball, became the best pitcher in our school, but he never saw me play a game. I worked hard to get straight A's, was always on the honor roll. Never once did he say he was proud of me. One year I was a cheerleader. He never came to a game. One year I was captain of the drill team. He never saw a performance. One weekend I tried to help him work on the car, but he was cross with me and I was in the way. I went into the house and made some cookies. He said I baked them too long. More and more I find myself retreating to my room on the weekend, sobbing violently, desperately, wanting him to care. Not once did he comfort me. He never read to me. He never tucked me into bed. He never hugged me. He never kissed me. He never said, I love you. I got married and had 4 kids. The last one was a boy, the only male descendant. We gave him my father's name. He wasn't impressed. Restless and dissatisfied with mothering, I went back to school. Somehow, without meaning to, I found myself studying civil engineering, the field of study closest to his profession. I worked as a surveyor last year, laying out lines just like the lines he had put in for years. I found myself thinking, if he could see me now, he'd be proud of me. What a power a father has over the direction of a daughter's life. Good or bad, present or absent, he's going to have an influence that lasts a lifetime. I think a lot of fathers leave their daughters to the mothers to raise, thinking a man's influence isn't necessary for girls. I'm 37 years old now and beginning to see how much I'm still compelled by a deep craving within to gain the approval of this most significant man. You see, if my own father doesn't think I'm worthwhile, I must be worthless. If my own father can't accept me, then I'm unacceptable. If my own father cannot love me, then I must be totally unlovable. If I'm truly worthless and unacceptable and unlovable, then God couldn't really love me. And certainly my dear husband, who is only human, couldn't really love me. I thank God that he's opening my eyes to these lies and showing me his truth. He has begun the process of healing, but the wounds are really deep. I fear the effects of the scarring will be with me while I remain on this earth. And I would say that they probably will. And they'll likely touch those four kids, because that's the power of fathering. The Bible talks about it as multi-generational impact. So if our homes, if our families are not going to be like that, then dads and moms, we're going to have to invest heavily in caring for each other with a grace-filled life. So here's the four values of a family oiled by grace: mutual unselfishness, sacrificial servanthood, committed endurance, deliberate encouragement. And boy, listen to me. The magnet in a home like that is so strong that you don't want to be anywhere else. What's the magnet? It's the magnet that's going to draw your children, your family, to want to be together in your home, in your place. It's all about grace. Just unselfishly giving to the others in your home what they may or may not deserve. And maybe this week you ought to sit down and write a note, dads and husbands, and just tell your wife and just tell your children how much you appreciate them, how much you're proud of them. There's some kids here. Maybe you need to be convicted this morning of some of your words and the lack of grace, maybe to your parents or to your brothers and to your sisters. And this morning you ought to confess it to God. Listen, if you've treated your parents or your brothers and sisters with words that lack grace, then you need to confess that before God. We need to change. Make a commitment to change. A couple of weeks ago, I suggested to you that every day you ought to get up and before you eat breakfast or before you go to work or before you go to school, before you start your day, that you reach into your closet and you put on your grace clothes. Before anything else happens, go find those grace clothes. Go find that grace face and put it on and see what it does to the atmosphere, to the aroma in your home. So this morning, I want to tell you again, you are the beloved recipient of the amazing grace of God in your life. This is the motivation for what we're talking about. There is a gospel-centered motivation. What we're talking about this morning, you have to connect it to this whole series. Otherwise, it's just behavior modification. I'm not talking about behavior modification. I'm telling you, there's the theological foundation. And you, this morning, are the beloved recipient of the amazing grace of God in your life. You did not deserve it. You did not deserve it. Amazing grace, how sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me. You did not deserve it, but God gave it to you. Now go out, and if you really understand what you've been given, go out and give it out to the people in your life, and God will be pleased.